welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Atul Wadachari, managing partner of Fannin, a Houston organization that's commercializing early-stage life science innovations by optimizing capital efficiency for these promising health tech treatments and medical devices. Life science innovation takes a significant amount of time and money to accelerate, and Atul shares how the Fannin model approaches these challenges while also contributing to developing Houston's life science innovation ecosystem. Atul, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Thanks, Natalie. Thank you for including me.
Well, we have a lot to talk about with Fannin and all of the work you're doing within life science innovation here in Houston. But before we even jump into that, let's talk a little bit about your very long career here in Houston in the business and life science community. So tell us about your career, the broad overview, and what's really drawn you to life science innovation in particular.
That's a great question, Natalie. It's hard to believe, but actually this year, I will have been a native Houstonian for 30 years. I moved to Houston in 94. I was in Baltimore before that. I did my medical training in India. Then I did my PhD and postdoc at Hopkins in Baltimore. And then I moved to Houston in 94 to join McKinsey. We came here because my wife came here for her Hemong Fellowship. And so, you know, it's been a long time in Houston, done a whole variety of things, both at McKinsey and subsequently and more broadly within the ecosystem. But I think really, if I think about to your final question, I mean, really, with my background of medicine plus research plus business, really what I wanted to do was find a way to apply all three of those. And so product development in making drugs and medical devices was really a logical place for doing what I do. And I like to tell people I have the best job in the world because I get to work on really interesting things, work with a lot of really smart people, but also do things which can hopefully be transformative. But just in terms of my background, you know, as I said, I moved to Houston in 94, joined McKinsey. And I think, I wanted to learn more about the business world at that point. And McKinsey was really a transformational experience for me. I was the first medical scientist in our Houston office. And so I got to serve a broad range of clients beyond the biomedical space. Being in Houston, I, of course, served energy clients, but I also served tech companies, a railroad, a paper mill, utilities, worked on projects globally, including in Europe, South America, Singapore, elsewhere. And McKinsey also gave me a year's leave of absence so I could work with what is today India's largest nonprofit education organization in education. And then in addition, you know, along with what we did at Fannin and subsequently also been involved in the broader ecosystem. I was president of the Indo-American Chamber of Commerce, president of Thai Houston, served as adjunct faculty for many years at Rice, at Baylor, at UT, and on the board, advisory board of a number of organizations, including BioHouston, Bio, Cancer Society, GHP, et cetera. So it's been a really rewarding 30 years that I've spent in Houston, and I think none more than the last decade plus that I've spent at Fannin.
Well, you're very tapped into the Houston innovation ecosystem, and your work these days is very focused on the life science space at Fannin, which has this mission, which you're going to explain a lot better than me, but you're developing and commercializing these early stage life science innovations in a bit of a different way than kind of people outside of life science innovation might take an early stage idea for a tech company and then develop that, right? Life science is a whole different beast. So how is Fannin working a little bit differently from an accelerator, incubator, research institution? And what does that difference make for the companies you're working with?
That's a great question. So I think there are two, three aspects to this. I think you hit on some of them. First of all, if you think about biotech development compared to, say, tech or software or many of those other things, I think people smarter than me have often said you have to think about this as a marathon versus a sprint. Right. I mean, the nice thing about a tech startup is that you can spend 6 months, a year, year and a half. You can quickly, you know, for a relatively small amount of money, you can get to effectively a minimally viable product. And then you can test that in the market and see what works, what doesn't work. In biotech, for example, to get to that minimally viable product can take a decade and tens of millions of dollars, right? So it's a fundamentally different approach to product development. And so we like to use the word product development because it's not just entrepreneurship, but it's actually truly product development, which is more professional. So something like incubator or an accelerator, those work really well for things where you can actually make huge amounts of progress in a relatively short period of time with good, strong mentors. So in biotech, you really need more than that, right? So that's one piece. The second piece is that organizations like a lot of the academic institutions in the last, if you think about it, one of the high priorities for academia in general is how do we take the amazing research that takes place in academia that creates new knowledge, but actually convert it into a product that can help people. And so that's, end of the day, reason why our taxpayers fund academic research. And so that's important to academic institutions. And so they often create mechanisms to try to mentor people and try to mentor faculty, try to create startups. The challenge is that product development is actually more complex. It requires innovation, but that's not sufficient. When you ask people why we lag in product development in the life sciences, although we are, home to the world's largest medical center and amazing institutions, we don't even make the list of top 10 biotech clusters. The usual answer is that we don't have enough biotech investors. But that actually puts the cart before the horse. Although innovation is important and necessary, as I said, it's not sufficient. Because as you know, investors invest in people and in management team, not just in ideas. And although we have an amazing pool of researchers and clinicians, we lack experienced product developers. If you go to Boston, I didn't mention this, but when I left McKinsey, I joined a biotech company, Agenix, which was developing an immuno-oncology drug licensed from Baylor College of Medicine. We took that drug to phase three clinical trial, then took it public through a reverse merger with a German biotech company. So somebody with my background, right, a medical scientist with phase three experience, you go to Boston, there are probably hundreds or perhaps thousands of people with that profile. You come to Houston, we have a handful of people with that profile. So when we created Fanon, we felt like we had to address what we saw as the twin bottlenecks, right, is the shortage of experienced product developers and early risk capital. And that's really what Fanon was all about in terms of saying we created a construct. I almost like to say we kind of tried to recapitulate in a tiny way what the Boston ecosystem looked like and create a construct that allows us to find ways to apply that experienced management team and early risk capital, if you will, at the very early stages of product development. And that is different from what an incubator or an accelerator does, because incubators, accelerators are really designed to help support effectively entrepreneurs and startup companies and help them succeed. In Fanon's case, we are the entrepreneurs, we are the startup company. And I can tell you a little bit more about how we're addressing those twin bottlenecks if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what you're working with companies across stages, still in this early stage, but really reaching a various amount of milestones while under your roof. So tell us about that.
Sure. So in one way, so as we think about Fanon, right, there are really three stages of programs slash companies at Fanon. The first stage is the programs that are entirely managed within Fanon. And so effectively, Fanon is the biotech company. Our team are basically the biotech team. The third stage are companies like Brevitas, Procerion, Pulmotech. These are companies we refer to them as Fanon established companies. They're really independent companies. They have their own management teams. They look like traditional biotech companies, if you will, biotech or medtech companies. Brevitas is commercial. Procerion is getting ready to do. It's doing its pivotal trial and hopefully get a FDA approval or submit for FDA next year. Pulmotech has finished a couple of phase three trials. So those are really mature programs. We are actively involved, but they are really, think of them as separate companies. And then you have effectively the transition programs, which are still within Fanon, actively managed by Fanon employees, but we bring in people with kind of additional capabilities to build out the company. So it's almost like, when you have a child and they transition to being fully independent. So the key innovation at Fanon is the piece that we did for the early stage company. As I mentioned, the twin bottlenecks we face in Houston are the shortage of experienced product developers and early risk capital. So we addressed that first bottleneck, the experienced product developers, by using a pooled management team, and the second by grant funding. So our experienced management team is basically driving the development of multiple programs. And we have about a little over a half a dozen different programs that we're driving. Those are typically all preclinical stage programs. Once they get closer to the clinic is kind of when we start spinning them out. And that has two big advantages. First of all, it's very capital efficient. And even more importantly, it provides technology with an experienced drug development team much earlier in the process than may be possible with a single asset startup, right? So if you really have an early stage preclinical startup, it is hard in Houston to attract somebody with experienced product development to run that program. By doing it within Fanon, we basically can apply that. And the reason it's possible is because there's a lot of lumpiness in early drug development, because there are often lags while you wait on, for example, experimental results. So that's one half of the bottleneck. And the second half of the bottleneck is the by going after grants to do the early de-risking, we avoid the limitation of early risk capital we have in Boston, in Houston. And because once the programs are de-risked, it becomes much easier and much less expensive to raise investor dollars. So effectively, we've tried to recapitulate what Boston has with our combined management team and grant funding, and it's been quite successful. You know, we've received a number of awards and recognition, and you know, the sincerest form of flattery, we've had a number of imitators, but we've largely kept our head down and advanced our programs. And in the last decade, we've raised over $225 million across our programs, including $75 million in grant funding, and achieved meaningful milestones for a number of these companies and programs.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, the way you describe it is here are the two problems that Houston's life science community kind of has, and here's the two-pronged approach that Fanon provides. And so I know you talked about the stages, and you even mentioned a couple of the companies, but for those unfamiliar, some of those companies, which I've covered on Innovation Map, but for those unfamiliar, what types of technology are you currently working on? And tell us a little bit about that and the impact they'll make on the medical community.
Sure. So we worked across multiple programs, and I think our core requirement is that we're working on programs that are in the biomedical space and that are complex to develop, right? So effectively, we take on hard programs. So our most advanced program is called Brevitest. It's a commercial diagnostic platform that can can perform immunoassays with the precision of a centralized lab, but the speed and ease of a point of care device. We first launched it commercially during at the height of COVID when we were doing antibody tests for COVID. And then more recently, we have pivoted and we are doing going after the forensic market. And so we're developing, we have a number of tests there for the forensic pathology market. So that's a commercial program. Procurion is another really exciting technology. It's actually it's developing Iotix, which is a percutaneous mechanical circulatory support device. What does that actually mean? It's a little baby pump. It's about kind of the size of a pencil that sits in the that goes in through a cath lab procedure, which obviously your listeners are very familiar with. But it sits in the aorta and it addresses one of the number one causes of mortality and morbidity in the country, which is patients have what are called cardiorenal syndrome. So these are patients with severe heart failure who no longer respond to medication. And the technology came out of Texas Heart. We've been developing it for over a decade. Again, these things take a long time. And we are right now in our phase three, or you know, what's called a pivotal trial in the device space, you know, equivalent to a phase three trial in the drug space. And we hope that we will go to the FDA for approval next year. As I said, it's probably addressing one of the largest device markets that's been around in the last many in several decades. And we'll actually be coming out with an announcement later this year about a significant financing event, which again, I think will be one of the larger financing events that has taken place for a medical device technology in Houston. And then our third spun out company, Pulmotech, which came out of MD Anderson and Texas A&M, is a clinical stage inhaled therapeutic. It stimulates the innate epithelial defenses of the lung and provides rapid protection against all major classes of pathogen. During PUL 40, during COVID, we actually had DoD support and conducted phase two clinical trials that showed statistically significant protection against respiratory symptoms in two randomized phase two trials. So those are our, if you will, commercial or clinical stage programs that are pretty much on their own and doing really well. And then we have half a dozen other programs that are a little bit earlier stage. Those are being run within the studio itself. Altrum is developing an antibody against protein called CD127. We've got over $25 million in funding, including over $20 million in grant funding from CPRIT and NCI. And we expect to enter clinical testing later this year. And our initial focus is on children with leukemia, but with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is one of the most common childhood cancers. And we have expansion opportunities, including in lymphomas, acute myeloid leukemia, and lung cancer. We have Raptamer Therapeutics is something I'm really excited about. It's developing a novel targeting modality for targeted therapies in cancer, autoimmune, other diseases. You know, today, if you look in the biotech space, two of the most exciting spaces are what are called antibody drug conjugates and radiopharmaceuticals. Our Raptamer Therapeutics sits right in the middle of both those two spaces and can play an important role there. We expect to enter clinical testing for that next year. Then again, Goldenrod is developing a first-in-class inhibitor for neurological diseases. We've got some really great data for substance use disorders, but we're also focused on a number of neurodegenerative diseases. And again, we have, you know, it's only available, great brain penetration, really exciting early efficacy data. We have a drug that we're currently in the process of developing, which is for treatment of myocardial infarction. So when patients get a heart attack, one of the problems is once the, you know, you have a stoppage of the blood to the heart, and then when the patients come to the hospital and then that stoppage is released, you get what is called ischemia reperfusion injury. And that actually causes a lot of damage to to the heart muscles. We have a drug that's inhibiting that. We have another anti-cancer drug. Anyway, I'll stop then. We've got a number of programs at different stages of development, but you know, it's a very broad range of programs.
Yeah, I appreciate that summary and that rundown because each of those companies and technologies could be its own podcast, but they're all doing such cool stuff. And as everyone just heard, you know, really across the board treatments from devices to therapeutics, from lungs to heart. So it's really interesting the scope that you're really tackling. And I just imagine you're juggling all of these companies at one time. And it's very impressive, and exactly what Fanon is doing. So one question that comes to mind is, and something we've spoken about prior to is how do you come across these types of technologies, and what's that onboarding process like? Because I'm sure not everything pans out like these companies have for you. What's that process look like?
Great question. So if you look at our programs, some of our programs are really in license from academic institutions, Pulmotech, Procerion, the ones that I mentioned, Altrum. These are all technologies that came in from academic institutions. And some of the programs are actually developed internally, and Brevitest is an example, as is our Raptamer platform. So the technologies that we in license, typically the conversation starts with, in many cases, it starts with academic researchers who are doing interesting work. We talk to them or they hear about us, maybe at conferences, scientific meetings, and they come and share what they're doing with us. And then we'll do some diligence. Eventually, if we do bring a technology in from an academic institution, we will, you know, get involved with the technology transfer office because it has to be licensed. But we do a little bit of early diligence, if you will. A lot of it is focused on, first of all, commercial, right? To make sure that this is an unmet medical need. Because again, our interest is in addressing problems that don't have solutions today. So that's almost like the first question is there a real unmet medical need that this program can address? Then the second is we do look at the competition. And once we know, you know, again, if this is going to be the seventh drug to treat a particular thing or the eighth checkpoint inhibitor for immuno-oncology, then that probably wouldn't be a good fit for our model. And so we kind of do a little bit of what the commercial check looks like, and then we'll dig a little bit into the biology. Once we have all of that in place, we then work with the tech transfer offices to in-license the technology. And the key difference between what we do and what most investors would do is we actually don't write a check up front to kind of develop the program. Our first step is to partner with the academic innovator, the researcher, to go after grant funding. And we think that's really important for a couple of reasons, right? First of all, we view this as a long-term relationship. So writing a grant together with an investigator, it's like you're dating. And so you really get a good sense for how the relationship is. More importantly, one of the biggest challenges with academic research for multiple reasons is that the majority of academic researchers' published data is not always reproducible. And so rather than trying to do a lot of diligence to figure out whether it's real or not, what we do instead is we will write the grant, and if the grant funding comes in, it allows us to get our hands dirty and actually work on the program and learn how it works rather than depending on external data for diligence. And once that initial grant comes in, then we can do the we can kind of do the I don't like to use the word diligence because we're actually working and reproducing the data, extending it. A lot of what we do early on is make sure we understand what the regulatory path looks like, what the tox path looks like, manufacturing, et cetera, looks like, because all of those pieces, which are really important for product development, but are not as exciting from an academic research point of view. And so that's really our partnership, is our academic collaborators are continuing to work on the things that are important and that are publishable. We work on the things that are important for our product development. And then as the programs advance and we feel it's appropriately de-risked, we will bring in outside capital, and over time we'll bring in people and build out the management team. So it's a long process, but it's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. I think that's it's interesting because yeah, you're really having to do a lot of mapping out and consulting crystal balls and figuring out what the future of the company is before making that onboarding process. So one of the things you mentioned in terms of this kind of need in Houston and life science in particular is the people to run these companies. Houston has had a shortage of that. That is something else Bannon is approaching with your talent development program. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, as we talked early, right? I mean, we saw the number one bottleneck in Houston being people with product development experience. And then we appreciated that really product development, like any complex task, right? You can learn a lot by classes, by textbooks, et cetera. You have to learn a lot of the basics, but then eventually you actually have to learn by doing. I like to say nobody can, it's shall we say, hard to learn to ride a bike just by watching YouTube videos, right? At some point you actually have to get onto a bike. So something like that, we felt like if you really want to have product development, people with product development experience, we need to have them go through the process. And unfortunately, Houston doesn't have a lot of big pharma or med tech device companies. And so we started off, we call it our talent development program now. At the start off, it started off as an internship. And that was typically, postdocs, graduate students, medical students, engineers at our academic institutions that would come spend 3 to 6 months working part-time. And so effectively, we would put them to work on all of the different aspects of product development, ranging from, designing experiments, doing diligence, looking at the whatever the regulatory path, all of that, right? So they get some hands-on experience. That program expanded. We then developed what we called a fellowship. We have product development associates, but the whole idea was to give more people with that academic or research background the product development aspect of it. And if you think about it, right, Houston has thousands of those people, right, of which a very small proportion will eventually go into academic research. And so this offers an opportunity. And so that program has actually grown into one of the largest of its kind. We've had now almost 350 people in the last decade that have gone through the programs. They come obviously from all of our local academic institutions, but also from institutions across the country. And about half of them are still in the Texas ecosystem and are important parts of our ecosystem. The other half have moved on to other jobs in other places, including virtually a large number of the major pharma biotech companies, device companies, investors, tech transfer offices elsewhere. So, for example, that technology I mentioned that for a heart attack, that technology came to us. One of our alums who's at an institution, academic institution, research institution overseas, reached out to us, right, with that technology, right? So that's actually been something which we are very proud of. I think if you really look at Fanon, virtually our entire core team, which is about 20 people, are all alums. And more importantly, I think these people have been important contributors to startup ecosystem in Houston. But even the ones that have gone out, right? I mean, when they come back, they are the people who can come back and work with. A couple of years ago, there was a panel at the Texas Life Sciences Forum, and all of the panelists were Fanon people or Fanon alums, right? So these are the people who have Texas roots, Houston roots, and they can come back and continue to help build the ecosystem. And I've been here, like I said, 30 years, and as I see the Houston ecosystem, it's continued to grow. And I think it's been growing for multiple reasons, but I think part of that is also that kind of the depth of, if you will, product developers with some product development experience. Again, I'm not going to pretend that we're spending 6 months at Fanon is comparable to spending 3 years at Amgen, but given what our resources are in Houston, these people are an important part of our growing ecosystem.
It's such a compliment to what you do at Fanon too, that those go hand in hand. Like you said, you have that dual bottleneck. And it is, I feel like Houston's life science ecosystem is small but mighty, and small because of this problem, and the fact that there's just not a lot of places for these talented individuals to go in Houston to really learn the ropes. So it's interesting when you think of, it's been 10 years now. What is the next 10 years of Fanon look like to you?
It's a great question. So I think if you had asked me this question 2 years ago, I might have had a different perspective. Because really, if you look at the last 10 years or 15 years of the biotech, and obviously what I'm talking about is really biotech focused. It's not, there's some overlap with tech and everything else. But if I talk about the biotech ecosystem, what's really happened, what happened for probably over 10, 15 years is money was basically free. And so there was huge amounts of money that was going into a whole bunch of early stage companies. Huge, literally, I mean, you had, triple digit $1 million Series A financings and things like that. Then, as you know, about 3 years ago now, two to 3 years ago, the funding market started tightening up. And really, the last year has been one of the toughest funding environments for biotech in the last 20 years, probably. And so all of a sudden, so it's actually very interesting. I'll step back a second, right? So the Fanon model, where we do the early stage funding with grants, it's actually great because it allows us to de-risk it easily and allows us to reduce dilution of the early stages. But the flip side is, so it's very capital efficient, but the flip side is it's not a speed to market play, right? Because it takes us time to write a grant, get the money. So it's a slower process of product development than if you can get somebody to write you a $10 million check. And so for many years, we used to get a lot of pushback from people that saying, why are you wasting all the time? I mean, with your model and what your track record, you should be able to raise a whole bunch of money and try to accelerate your programs because that's really what's important. But we felt it's more appropriate. Think of us as value investors rather than growth investors. But then in the last couple of years, it's actually very interesting. Suddenly, with the economic environment being what it is, people come to us and say, how did you come up with this idea of doing being capital efficient? And it's like, okay, well, we've been doing it for a decade. But long-winded way of coming back to your question, really, where are we at Fanon, right? I think we've got several companies that are on the cusp of, having really large, important milestones. I think that when we do that, I think there'll be further recognition of the value of the Fanon model. What that translates to, I'm not sure. I don't know that we want to raise a whole bunch of money because that'll, if you have too much money, that's as bad in some ways as having too little money. Because I think our current focus on trying to say we use grant money to de-risk it, that allows us to also use, external, if you will, market forces to prioritize our program and be capital efficient. So I'd like to believe we'd like to continue doing that. But on the other hand, if we have more money, we might be able to shorten the path from when we do the initial grant funding to when we're able to get the programs into standalone advanced programs. So I think I think the important question that we'll have to think about in the next couple of years is how much further do we continue with the fan-in model? Do we change the amount of money we bring in at the stage we bring in? Do we try to replicate what we do in other parts of the country, right? Because there are probably a dozen other places like Houston around the country that have huge innovation ecosystems, academic ecosystems, but not a big biotech ecosystem. So I think those are the questions that we will wrestle with over the next year or two.
Yeah, it's a lot to think about. And I think what is interesting about Fanon that the way and the with the intent that it was set up as to be capital efficient, you really make yourself kind of immune to some of the challenges of a changing market. Because, there was lots of money, then now there's less money, but shouldn't affect Fanon in theory because you're already so efficient with capital and making the most out of grant funding too. So that's really interesting and very, applicable to Houston.
The only caveat I'll make is I don't know that it won't affect us. It definitely we can weather it because we were actually getting ready to raise a large amount of money middle of last year. We in the environment we kind of pivoted, and so we were able to continue. But we did for our most advanced program, Presurion, we did go ahead and do a large financing, and like I said, there will be an announcement later this week. And so I think it's a function of, at the appropriate time, I think bringing large amounts of money is possible and appropriate. At the earlier stages, the capital efficiency is important. And I guess I didn't mention, I should have that, my partners in there, it was Leo Lindbeck the third and Mark Warshay are kind of the partners with whom we worked in terms of establishing the Fanon model now more than a decade ago. So, it's really important for us to have, three different people with very different backgrounds and skill sets that can kind of work and think through what we are doing.
Well, talking about the market and what's happening in life science innovation in general, what's happening in life science innovation in Houston? I mean, obviously, Fanon has been a key player over the years. And over that decade plus, Houston has evolved a lot. When you look at that evolution of Houston as a whole within life science innovation, what are some of the changes you've witnessed and where is it headed?
So I think to your first question, what's happening in life sciences, biotech, medtech, globally, or at least in the US, is, as I said, we've come through one of the toughest markets in the last couple of years, financing markets. It still needs to be seen whether 2024 is a turnaround year or whether 2025 is a turnaround year. But irrespective, it'll change because demographically, as we continue to age, we continue to become a richer society. The long-term trends for biotech, medtech is clearly, especially for biotech, is really on the upswing, right? So it'll continue to be a really important part of the ecosystem and it'll continue to grow. In some ways, and I think this happens after any downturn, right, is that you have a lot of companies that will exit. And so once everything comes back to normal, then you will start, all of a sudden, it switches from a buyer's market to a seller's market. You're already beginning to see some of that. And I think that's likely to happen to biotech in the next few years. So people and companies who are able to weather the storm successfully are in a good place. In terms of Houston, I think, unfortunately, the funding challenges in kind of more globally across the US and globally probably have a bigger impact on smaller players like Houston. So we definitely have been hit hard. But I think clearly we've got the kind of the base elements required to be a successful ecosystem are there and they continue to grow. I think there are two major contributors, right, that I'll talk to. I think one is I talked about Fanon and what we've been doing, but I should also mention CPRIT, which is the Cancer Prevention Research Institute of Texas. And CPRIT has actually funded a whole bunch of companies, both local companies and companies that have relocated. So I like to say, right, if you think about product development, it's really around the management team, the CEOs. And I like to say it's a buy versus build problem. So when you have a late stage technology, clinical stage technology, or you have a lot of money, it's actually relatively easy to attract really experienced leaders to lead the programs. We've done that in Fanon many times. Houston has done it over a dozen times. And CPRIT really helps that process, right? Because if you can get $20 million, then you can actually attract an experienced management team. The challenge is the really early stage programs, the preclinical programs. You're not going to get an experienced person to relocate from San Diego to Houston. So that's where kind of the Fanon's talent development program, which is creating the next generation of CEOs, really helps. So I think between these two factors, as well as everything that's been happening in terms of incubators, accelerators, efforts by the kind of TMC and J Labs and the academic institutions, I think all of these coming together, I think we're going to continue seeing a growth in the ecosystem. Typically, what happens is you need one or two really big success stories. And once those big success stories happen, and especially if those success stories then result in that company being sold, leaving behind experienced product developers with money in their pockets, that's often what will then supercharge the next cycle of development. So I'm hoping that'll happen in Houston, in the next years, whether it's 5 years or a decade or so, to be, and again, it's unpredictable, but I think that's really, we have the basics in place, and I think, we're looking for that acceleration event, which hopefully will happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and hopefully it is a Fanon company that is among the successful. That'd be great too, huh?
Absolutely, but we'll take any success, right? That's the nice thing about we. And the other thing is that we actually do have had a lot of successes in the ecosystem, and we need to do a better job of sharing those successes and celebrating those successes because ours is a long, as I said, it's a marathon, right? So when you're running a marathon, I've run a half marathon, and having those people every 50 yards cheering you on matters, right? So something like that. We do need to find ways to celebrate interim successes as we go along and do a better job of that. And I think what you're doing, I think, is an important contributor to that piece.
Absolutely. I mean, it all comes back to this idea that a rising tide lifts all boats, right? So definitely something that I think Houston is due for. So it's very interesting to talk to you about all of this and to see the role Fanon has played and all of the interesting stuff that you're doing. I cannot believe you do this all with a team of 20 people. So that's very impressive. And thank you so much for joining me today to tell Fanon's story.
Great. Thank you so much, Natalie. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.